In a paddock on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, up around Kempsey, there's a tree, a big old Moreton Bay fig tree. Must be 100 years old, this tree. Its branches stretch out high and wide. Its roots go deep, must be a long way down. And the exposed roots are like the shoulders of a buried giant. You couldn't kill this tree. Now, the vast old tree is in the grounds of a former state-run children's home, and it has deep significance for the boys who were forcibly sent there. That boy's training home was Kinchula, a sort of Aboriginal boys' training farm. Like prisoners, the boys were dehumanised. They were known by numbers. Some, like one of the men you'll hear from shortly, were explicitly told to forget their Aboriginality and to be white. The sexual and physical violence, and the degradation they experienced behind those iron gates, produced generations of rage-filled men, some of whom did not survive. But as the rusted links of that chain are overgrown and disappear, literally swallowed by that tree, some of the former residents of the Kinchula Boys' home heal a little.
I am James Michael Whitty Welsh. I was number 36 when I was in the place called Kinchula Boys' home. I am a Wailwan man, and my people are the protectors of the black ducks. I was taken from a little place called Kunnable. It's my people's language. In European language, is Coonamble.
Yeah, my name's Richard Patrick Campbell, and was formerly known as number 28 in Kinchula Boys' home. I'm from a little town called Bowerville on the north coast, but I reside in Kempsey. That's only about 15 kilometres from Kinchula Boys' home, and that's the Dungari people. On my father and Goombanga on my mother, and Bunjalung on my great grandmother.
We are everywhere, aren't we?
Yeah,
Bunjalung
yeah.
people. Michael, how old were you when you went to Kinchula Boys' home?
I was 8 years old. Daniel, when they grabbed me, there was seven of us taken off my mother at the same time. I had a older brother. He was 10. Youngest brothers and sisters were 6 months old. Sorry. You get this emotion coming out of me when I talk about these things because it takes me back, right back to 1960. Yeah, there were seven of us. We got separated at Central Railway Station. Me and my eldest brother, Barry, at the time was 10. We went to Kinchula.
Central here in Sydney?
Central here, yeah. That was a splitting point. You find out with most of them that come from either... definitely from the other side of the Blue Mountains. You just heard Richard talk about where he's come from and I come from. There's 600 kilometres different between where he is and Ed straight out west, and you'll land upon my land, my people's land.
Do you remember that parting at Central Station?
Oh, yeah. This is why I get emotional about it. As an eight-year-old, I was well aware. I danced around the campfires around my grandfather's hat and around with my grannies and uncles. And my brother, I just got to mention this, that he was a 10-year-old, and at the age of 10, in the Wailwan people's language culture, he was just about ready to become involved with the men business, and it caused him even more problems. He passed away at 43 from trauma, yep, mm-hmm. a bad part of life. But Central Station is where they told us that we were going on a train, and our brothers and sisters were going to come on the train behind us. But I used to go crayfishing. I used to go pig catching, settle the horses up at my age before they took me. So what they were telling me, I knew that wasn't true. I didn't know what the word bullshit was, but that's what it was.
Richard, do you remember that when you were parted from your family?
Yeah, it was on Bowerville Mission. Myself, older brother and three younger sisters, we went from there and... we went to the court in Maxwell, and that's why they gave us a charge. And the first charge was actually neglect, you know. So, and it's still on the charge sheet. So you'll find out with a lot of Indigenous stolen generation kids. That's the first charge I'll ever get. And then from there we went to we drove. We never got in a train. I think they drove us straight across over to Kinchula, and that's about probably back then probably an hour and a half from where I live, Barrowville. And then they dropped us off, and then held us there, and they took off with the three younger sisters. You can hear them crying, you know, screaming, going down the street from KBH.
Did your sisters go to Cootamundra? Where did they go?
They went to Bomaderry.
Oh.
See, the connection between Bomaderry, Cootamundra and Kinchula, if you was a baby, you know, a young male baby, they would have sent you to these different institutions like where all the girls are, and the girls would have looked after you. And as soon as you turned 5 or 6, they would have sent you up to Kinchula Boys for slave labour.
That's Richard Campbell, a former inmate of the notorious Kinchula Boys home near Kempsey, where he was identified by the number 28. The boys who passed through the gates of the home between 1924 and 1970 were not known by their names, as we've heard. Indeed, they were prevailed upon immediately to forget who they were. Richard Campbell is a Gumbangir and Dungudi man, and he remembers the first punishment he received was on the day he arrived at Kinchula.
And so I was 9 year old then, you know, just going on 10. But the first thing he just started belting into us. He said, "Okay," he went, "Bang, you are not Richard Campbell. Bang, you are 28. And just kept going like that. The next one, "Bang, you are not black, you are white. Bang, you are not Aboriginal anymore, you know. You're a white fella now, so, and forget about your language." This was all, you know, in between hits, you know, around the head, you know, so, and not with a hand, it was a fist, you know, so imagine a grown man's fist hitting, you know, two young boys, you know, so my brother, he was 11, you know, and I was just going on 10, so. And, you know, that's a sort of first punishments that I ever got. And
that was your welcome to Kinchula.
Welcome to Kinchula, boys. I was just going to say, when he said Kinchula, the pearly, no pearly gates there, wasn't there, you know, so, you know, and our chairperson, he always calls it the gates of hell, so, yeah, all the boys do.
Now, Michael, after that very traumatic parting with your siblings, your brothers and sisters at Central Station, what do you remember then of when you arrived at Kinchula?
The gates. When we got there, the ride, yeah, no, it was Barry. Barry was my protector at that time. But when we got there to the gates and we were going to walk them through the gate,
Barry was one of your brothers?
He's my brother. He was the eldest. He was 10 and with the two go. And he cuddled me as we went through, and he said, "It'll be all right, brother." I didn't want to go in there. I couldn't. I knew this place was no good. It was evil. Just you're looking at old White, I mean, Frank White it was, he was standing up on the thing and just looking at him.
Frank White was the name of the man who...
He was the manager of Kinchula Boys Home at the time that I landed there. Right.
Frank White.
Yeah.
Appropriated.
Yeah. It's an appropriate... And I'll tell you, he was dressed in all bloody white too. He had white socks pulled up, white shorts and a bloody white, creamy sort of a short that looked really white, and white shirt. And, yeah.
You were terrified?
Terrified. And just a little bit... On that there, just quickly, Daniel, he took us upstairs. It was he had to go up to the office in this place, and we were up there, and we were looked outside out there, and I could see that bloke shoveling, digging a hole, and Ben Barry, and curiosity, of course, we said, asked what he was doing, and old Frank White said he's digging a 6 foot by 6 foot hole, and we looked at each other, me and my brother, and then got the best of me. I said, and I said, what's he going to do? Because I was thinking it's a grave, 6x6. And I said, what's he going to do when he's finished digging it? And he said, well, he's going to fill it back in again. And, yeah, that how you look just then is just exactly as little children, that's what he looked. And that was his punishment. And I learnt later on in life he was Donkey Brown, Brian Marshall, but he was a very gentle man. I loved him for his comedian little things he used to do with us and help us out for the trauma time. But, yeah, that's just... So that added to the fear of...
Seeing someone digging what you thought was a grave.
Yeah, yeah.
But what was he actually doing? It was like an exercise?
No, he was on punishment. He dug that and he was going to dig that all day until
the sun. So another young fella here digging what you thought was his own grave.
He was all... I thought, yeah. And
but he turned out to be a good bloke.
Oh, he was unbelievable. Mm. He was... I just got to say, I've got to tell you, he used to fold his ears up and poke them in. And this was obviously where he got the name Donkey from. And and one of the things I will never forget is a lover we had a swimming pool, but it was just filled up by river water. Mm-hmm. He'd go underwater, and as he'd come out, you'd see him coming out, and he'd look like an hippopotamus, and then he'd go
with the ears tucked in.
And he'd blow his breath, and his ears would flop out like that. That was beautiful, as the older brothers of the homes there, they looked after us in every way they could. Mm. Played games and made us happy until the staff come around. You shut down when they come around.
You're on RN. This is Away with me, Daniel Browning. In 1965, a glowing report on the conditions at Kinchula was published in the widely distributed Dawn. Now, it was a monthly magazine produced by the New South Wales Aborigines Welfare Board to promote its assimilationist practices, which included the removal of children to orphanages and to training homes throughout the state.
It's almost like a country club at Kinchula. If you go to Kempsey, it won't be long before you hear about the boys from Kinchula. And if you meet one of them, you will know why the people of Kempsey hold the boys in such high esteem. They have built their high reputation by showing wonderful sportsmanship, cleanliness and attention to dress that is amazing when one considers that they are young boys without parents. The home lies on the southern bank of the Maclay River, about 16 miles from Kempsey. It is a beautiful and tranquil spot. The rich soil on the 41 acres of the home makes it almost self-supporting. A milking herd of 20 cows and a large vegetable garden serve the dual purpose of providing food and agricultural training for the boys. Although discipline at such an establishment must be reasonably strict, the boys at Kinchula cannot hide their affection for the Henriksons. This certainly is not a one-sided thing, because the Henriksons give the same kindness and affection to the Aboriginal boys as they give to their own two boys. In fact, they feel they have 39 children. Mr. Henrikson told Dawn that he had the most bonza bunch of kids in Australia. After seeing the setup at Kinchula, Dawn feels that you would have to go a long way before you found better. Dawn, August 1965.
Now, Richard Campbell's account of his own childhood differs wildly from that of Dawn. And Richard doesn't hesitate when I asked him to recount the worst of his experiences at Kinchula.
Getting raped by the manager. And that was an ongoing thing, you know, like every week when he's drunk, you could smell him coming in, you know. And, you know, not only myself, other boys used to get it too. So, you know, he used to come in just on certain nights, just on that certain evening, you know, and he'd take someone else, you know, and you're very thankful with someone else, or, you know, you just don't want to think about it that way, you know, but you're not getting it towards yourself. You know, and listen to someone else crying in the distance, you know, just up around the corner, you know, you can hear them crying and things like that. So, you know what was going on.
It's unbelievable. So,
Daniel, those words that you just said, that's how we felt. Who are we going to tell? Who's going to believe us? And so with this here and what you're doing here now, I want to thank you so very much for it, because this is the only way that we're going to be able to give our children any chance, because this, if molestation, if it's not that with the physical part of the body, they do it to our minds, and then mentally. It creates. It's a mental thing that is passed down to our children, and so
When blackfellas talk among each other about places like Kinchula, there's no other word that kind of has the same reaction. I think we all feel people who weren't there, you know, you probably your children and grandchildren, we all have the sense that something terrible happened to our relations there. Cootamundra has the same effect.
The thing about that, you know, like we only just started talking about it 5 years ago, you know, as a group, you know, on our own, we wouldn't talk about it. But I just got in with the boys 4 years ago. They were together since 2001, 2002, hey, Russ?
A little bit longer than that, but us, Kinchula,
They just kept coming home because I actually, you know, live in Kempsey, and they saying, you've got to come down with us. I said, no, I don't want to go to the other place. I'll burn the place down, you know, with all you fellas in it, you know, because I still had that rage. And then when I finally, you know, convinced myself to go and talk to the boys, you know, and I'm hearing these things, that same incidents that happened to me, you know, and all his memories just kept coming back and back, you know. I think it... Well, these fellas are doing something right here, you know, talking about this shit, you know. Mm. So, and I thought I'd, you know, come in and say, now we've got a powerful voice, and that's together, and a lot of people seem to don't like it because we're telling the truth, you know. So, you know, if they don't like it, they can hump it. You know, they created this history, you know. Why not listen to their history? They created it, you know. We were part of it.
What do you say to people like Andrew Bolt and other people who deny that there is a stolen generation?
Well, go and take his kids away. See what he thinks.
This is The Punishment Tree on RN with me, Daniel Browning. And today we're marking the 20th anniversary of the tabling of the report of the National Inquiry into the Stolen Generations, into the forcible removal of Aboriginal children from their families. I'm with two survivors of the Kinchula Boys' Home near Kempsey. They are Richard Campbell, who's a Gumbangi and Dungari man, and Michael Welsh, who's a Walwin man from Canamble. Now, at the heart of their story is a vast old Moreton Bay fig tree, and we'll soon find out why.
Right here, this moment, you're looking at two brothers that are healing ourselves while we're talking to you, you know? And that's it. And we understand that it's the most important thing. I look in your eyes and I say you are genuinely listened and concerned and feel. And these are the things that everybody knows. You stand up and look into somebody's eyes. If you would have watched Andrew Bolt, he was asked the question, has he ever spoken to a Kinchula Boys man or boy, whichever they wanted, and he never answered. He couldn't answer because he's never done it. And you would have seen first contact. I had a bit of a yarn with David Alterfield or whatever they call it. Alterfield, whatever he is. Well, you'd have looked at him and you'd have seen that he couldn't look me in the eyes properly anyhow. So,
but what, you know, like where did these fellows get the information from, you know? Don't they get it from the people who actually were in there? What I see is, you know, like Alfield and Bolt and what was that other bloke in that Sydney Morning Herald? What was his name? Windshuttle.
Yeah, Windshuttle. Jones, too.
They read it in books, you know, about... that's the only place they got it from, by a non-Indigenous person who actually talked to these kids, that young or men that was in boys' home. They read it from books about the stolen generation. You know, and these fellas would be about the same age as the people that was in, you know, keep looking after us, you know, and caring for us. Even might have been our managers, you know. See, they would have known.
20 years ago, the National Inquiry into the Forced Removal of Aboriginal Children, presided over by the former High Court Judge Sir Ronald Wilson, handed its findings to the Commonwealth in the Bringing Them Home report, and it included 54 recommendations. But at the time, former Kinchula Boys Home inmate Richard Campbell was completely oblivious.
20 years ago, I think I was still trying to kill myself, you know, through alcohol and that, you know, so that was my
You weren't even thinking about it?
No, wasn't even thinking about it. You know, I'd never even thought of it, you know, only till probably later on, probably another 10 years after that when I started to realise I wanted an education, you know, to learn again. But what came out of it? You know, I don't know what came out of it. You know, this bringing them home report, nothing's come out of it because they're still taking the kids away. And it's a lot bigger rate than what it was when we were taken away, you know, whether it's through alcohol, drugs and domestic violence and that, you know, but nothing hasn't changed a bit. So they're still controlling. You know, that's what it's all about, control. And they're using their kids to control us. 67, you know, like, you know, old Charlie Perkins came to Kempsey and yet the Kinchula was still going lively, you know. You know, it was good for him to come in and do all this stuff, you know, but why didn't he come down, to, you know, and try and do something about the boys getting raped and, you know, ridiculed and, you know, and whipped and bashed and, you know, and shoved through the shit and mud and things like that. So that's my question.
Mm. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday.
They get treated and neglected from things that they were talented, they were beautiful, they had everything going for them, but they were, again, being segregated in the community, from them. And this is something that I wanted to fight to try and find out. Why has this happened to my children? Because I fought just about every person that I needed to fight, and I didn't beat them all, but I tell you what, I give them a shock or two, you know. Now I realise now the importance of our stories. We couldn't tell the story because we didn't think anybody would believe us. And we thought everybody knew what was happening to us in that place. And so, because when we did finally go to a white school, we were told not to walk on the same side of the street where the other Aboriginal, local Aboriginal in Kempsey were, not to talk to them, otherwise we were going to get flogged or whatever. And so we were too terrified. They had a perfect technique of putting terror into us so that we couldn't tell anyone. Even when they got molested or we molested or belted, who were we going to tell? Because we thought the people already knew. So when I got out there, all I wanted to do is I wanted to kill every bloody person, you know, especially the people
who... You were so full of rage.
Rage and white. And when they introduced to my father...
Think about it, like, with that rage, they taught us to do that.
Mm.
We didn't know...
You thought it was normal.
We thought it was normal, you know, to hit someone, you know, because it was done unto us. You know, and we was kids, but when we came out, we were young adults, you know, and young adults, and we were mighty fit and strong, and you know, anything came to us, all we wanted to do was just smack them, you know, just build them, smash glasses over their heads, and you know, get anything, you know, what you see anywhere in the streets.
It's like survivors from, you know, from a war. People who come back from the war think that fighting is, some people who come back from the war think it's normal to fight, and you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, all you see all these things and you're exposed to all this suffering that you think it's normal. Both of you said that you believed that everyone knew what was happening at Kinchula.
We, without a doubt, we
you just thought the government was all right with all of this, and this is what the government wanted.
Look, it was perfectly done. You know, as we sit down and talk about it, and we can explain certain things now as we go by, you know. The way that they did it was when I was there the first time, we didn't go to any white school. We were just, it was Kinchula Boys' Home itself. Everything was Kinchula Boys' Home. And then we got shifted to go to West Kempsey and a couple, and the other schools.
63.
Now, in that, they thought, and we get a lot of feedback today, they thought because we were dressed up, they give us shoes and dressed us up and made us all real pretty to go to school. And when we got back in the gates again, they took all that stuff back off us again. And the shoes, we were running around barefoot. I preferred barefoot foot anyhow. So, and we were in a swimming pool. Now, they said we had a swimming pool. That swimming pool was used for evil reasons of chucking our children in there at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, or brothers in the morning, or sooling the dog on it. They had this German Shepherd dog, a couple of them, and one was named Prince, and they used to sool him onto us just for the fun of it.
Sick him. Like, get him.
Chase him. And also, he bitted a couple of the brothers, and he put me up on the water tank real quick. I learnt the climb up there.
also, he had a name.
Yeah, of course, he had a name.
The dog had a name.
We had numbers.
Same as all the cows. All had a name.
If we didn't remember, all numbers.
We was all numbered. You know, if we didn't remember their names, you know, you can imagine what happened to the boys.
I've got to say this. It hurts me, but we've heard and QCs say that law and justice has got nothing to do about it. With it, it's all about the purpose. Now, I tossed that purpose around for 20 bloody years in and out of a flag and bottle, and the only thing I could see out of that purpose that comes to any sense to me is the purpose is to keep the general society protected and keep the Indigenous people under control. That's why I need help, and I come down here to get help and to give my children a chance, because I'm 65 and that's a pretty good bat for us. I tell my children, they don't like me saying it. I said, in 15 years' time, if I make it, I'll be 80. Oh, Dad, don't talk like that. Dad, don't. I'll be gone. I said, the truth is, I will be gone. I've got to get things ready for use, you know, and this is it, you know. When I say my children, my youngest is 23, my oldest is 47. And last time I had a count, there was about 33 of us, and I stopped at 33 because...
Well, that's grandchildren.
He can only count his great
33, all from you.
All of it, exactly. So, you know, and they all...
No wonder we're the fastest growing population.
Hey, we need... We want that. We need to do that.
We need because, more people.
Yeah, we do, yeah. Yeah, thank you so much.
You know, with black people, you know, like we laugh, we go on, but our spirituality comes from within us and from the land itself, eh?
There's not much joy in this story, but the trauma the boys endured at Kinchula had one positive effect. What it did was deepen the fellowship between these men. Now, they've established an incorporated Aboriginal organisation for former inmates of Kinchula. It's called the Kinchula Boys Home Aboriginal Corporation. When the boys, Michael Campbell and Richard Welsh, let's call them boys, when they go back to Kinchula for commemorations, such as the 90th anniversary 3 years ago, both of them zero in. They go down and walk down near that old tree, that big old Moreton Bay fig tree that's in the grounds of the former home, which, incidentally, is now a drug and alcohol rehabilitation centre. Now, as they talk, the story unfolds about why that tree is so significant.
Up at Kinchula, there's a tree there. It's a massive big fig tree, Moreton Bay fig tree. And that's where they used to chain the boys up in the night, you know, and do whatever they liked with it. But, you know, every time it goes back, that actual tree is growing over this chain. There's only 2.5 links left of the chain.
So still the tree is kind of swallowing
it. It's swallowing
the chain.
Because it felt our pain when we was actually, you know, like getting chained up and, you know, raped and things like that there. But it felt our pain, you know, and it's growing over that pain.
I'm just thinking, and I've said to Richard and a few of the others, I said, I'm hoping around when I see those last two links swallowed in.
That's right.
Because that big tree now is our power.
That's it's our power. You know, this way we generate our being of who we are. Mm-hmm. And that's powerful. Just like this massive big tree. You want to go and see it, man. You know, up around your place, there are a lot of big fig trees. This is a big tree.
It's going to be a nice day when that last link disappears.
Just swallowed.
Gone,
yeah.
Richard Campbell and Michael Whitty Welsh, former inmates of the Kinchula Boys' Home near Kempsey.
I am the tree, the lean, hard, hungry man, the crow and eagle, sun, moon and sea. I am the sacred clay which forms the base. The grass is vines and men. I am all things created. I am you, and you are nothing but through me the tree. You are, and nothing comes to me except through the one living gateway to be free. And you are nothing yet for all creation, earth and God and man. He is nothing until they fuse and become a total sum of something. Together fused to consciousness of all, and every sacred part away, alive into real affinity. A total sum of something. Together fused to consciousness of all, and every sacred part away, alive into real affinity.
From a poem by Kevin Gilbert, the song Trees, performed by Bart Willoughby and friends. And Bart is on the grand organ at the Melbourne Town Hall with vocals by Deline Briscoe. This is Away on RN.